I came back this morning from France, where our assault formations are ashore and now fighting like wildcats to hold the bridgeheads, to hold them against German generals and German armies who know that in the next few days they either throw us into the sea or lose the war. I've come back for a few hours to tell you what I can of what I saw in the few immortal hours in which we crashed through the famous German West Wall and so began the liberation of France
and of Europe and of the world.
I went in with the Canadian assault formation. I've come back to tell you how those superb British and Canadian assault troops went almost contemptuously through minefields and curtains of machine gun fire to clear the beaches and storm the casemates and rush the pillboxes and kill the Germans with the bayonet, those that didn't surrender, and many did surrender, and then push on to their objectives miles beyond. I've come back to tell what it felt like when the dream came true, the dream of going back to France. What it felt like to swim and wade ashore and go up the shell-swept beach and of the wild, weeping, lovely welcome of our liberated friends. But where and how should one begin? And what should one say after taking part in one of the greatest and most dramatic events of all time? At this moment, a feeling of unreality comes over me. Only 3 days ago, we went aboard our assault landing craft in English harbors for the start of the mighty enterprise. What lay before us, we didn't know. We knew that some of us would not come back. That hour seems a lifetime away, because since then we've lived a lifetime. Since that hour, we have crashed into France. For my own part, I can hardly say how strange it is to be back in England and saying, I've been to France with the assault and come back. I've been up the beaches that one had dreaded so long and seen this great event in history. And I'm back in England talking about it. First, I must say that I can't satisfy the hunger you must have for concrete news. We just can't afford to tell the Germans anything of value. I can't describe our order of battle. Who was on the left of the British forces? Who in the center and who on the right? You know we are in Normandy, between the mouth of the Seine and the Cherbourg Peninsula, but I cannot name the towns and villages. I can't describe what our fire plan was as we came in from the sea, nor the secret weapons that helped to get us ashore, nor the way we fooled the Germans about time and tide, nor the tanks and guns we've got ashore, nor the number of prisoners we've taken, nor many other things. I can only describe some of what I saw in those two splendid and terrible days. First, there was the strain of the last hours in London, waiting for the telephone to ring and summon us away. And then there were the few days spent in the loveliness of the country. The country had a special beauty and a sharp poignancy now that one was leaving it on such a dangerous adventure. One thing I shall never, never forget is being wakened just before sunrise on that last day by the dawn chorus of the singing birds, dozens of them, especially the nightingales. Then there was the exciting hour when we were briefed, the hour when we learned at last what the world was holding its breath to know, where we were going and when, and it was to France. Most of us had guessed France, of course, but some had thought Denmark and some Holland. I'd guessed that we'd smash in between Calais and Dunkirk and make a bold effort to cut France off from Germany. And so at last we went aboard our ships. Then there was a 24-hour postponement and the awful strain. We waited tensely all one day, lest there should be news of a second postponement. The weather didn't look too good, but then the word came to go, and the greatest armadas ever seen steamed out toward France and the dark. We waved goodbye to England long before sunset, and we gasped and gaped at the wonderful sight as the hundreds and thousands of invasion craft, flotilla after flotilla, deployed into lines astern. Warships and big troop carriers and headquarters ships and assault landing craft and tank landing ships and assault craft of every description, covering the waters in every direction. People on shore were waving. They must have known that this was it, that this was the eve of D-Day. In the lounge of our ship that night, we pored over our maps. But then we played bridge or gathered round the piano and sang. We were going where our fathers and brothers had gone 25 years ago, and we sang the same songs they sang. There was one we sang more than others. There's a long, long trail a-winding. And I began to wonder if it wasn't a dream after all, playing bridge and singing as we approached the beaches of Hitler's Europe. The assault was to be in broad daylight. We were to go in on a rising tide, so that there'd be just enough water to carry the assault craft over the underwater hedgehogs and mines, but not so much that the marine engineers couldn't get at the obstacles to blow them. But the waters were rough. Even the heroic commando sappers couldn't always do their job, and some craft had to go ashore where no lanes had been cleared. It was absolutely astonishing to stand on deck in the early morning before H hour, the moment when the battle was to start. It was bewildering. There was this enormous armada at anchor right off the coast of France, in broad daylight, and nothing was happening. Not a thing. Not a gun. Not a bomb. It was fantastic. A soft dawn with the sky overcast, and not a thing to be seen or heard except the vast flotilla on the coast of France. We stared at the villages and the tall church spires of Normandy, and there was not a sound. But at last it started, the enormous bombing and shelling of the coast defenses. We came in from the sea that morning with a terrific volume of firepower. The hundreds of aircraft were dropping thousands of tons of bombs. The cruisers and destroyers were going close in to pound the shore batteries on casemates. And we had other weapons. And in a few minutes, we could hardly see the beaches for smoke. And then, at last, H hour. And at H hour, there was a sudden and almost frightening silence. The fire program ceased. It was the moment for the assault troops to go ashore, following the sappers who were clearing gaps through the mines. Armored bulldozers went in with them to make exits from the beaches, and other vehicles to blow up the mines and throw bridges over the concrete walls. At H hour, the small infantry landing craft were in on the rough rising tide, and thousands of troops were jumping ashore. At first, the volume of any enemy fire was not too terrible. The barrage and the bombing, as we expected, had stunned the Germans if it hadn't killed them. And this gave most of the assault troops the crucially precious few minutes to jump and wade and get ashore and go into action. By the time the Germans came to, these incomparable stormtroops were rushing the strong points. We got over some stretches of beach almost without opposition. On others, there were fierce and bloody fights. Our casualties were actually lighter than we expected in breaking into France, and we hadn't expected too many. But there were losses. The Germans were behind their concrete with heavy machine guns and field guns registered on the beaches. At best, we had to lose men. And when I got ashore, a few of the finest soldiers that ever attacked were lying dead in the sand or floating in the water. I was with the Canadians. And I say the Canadians had everything. Wonderful skill, as well as wonderful dash. Before the assault began, I thought the optimism of the officers was too high. I would say, yes, but suppose you don't get to this lateral road, or that high ground, or some other objective at the set time. What then? And always the reply came, but there's no question about it. We will get there. We'll get farther. And they did. There were delays that day on some beaches. But when D-Day ended, we had all our objectives and more. There was one great regiment, none of whose men had ever seen battle before, which fought like tigers all day, and at night had taken some high ground beyond their objective many miles inland. I suppose that the most surprising and wonderful thing that happened on Tuesday was what did not happen. At best, we expected ferocious sea and air battle round and above us. We expected that some of the German shore batteries would be intact, big guns with a range of many miles. And here was a target of thousands of ships. We expected that at any cost, the Germans would throw hundreds of bombers in against us. We expected the sky to be a cracking inferno of air battles, with planes crashing into the sea everywhere. We expected that some at least of the German E-boats and submarines would get in among us. But there was nothing. And believe me, nothing was wonderful that morning. In the first hours, I didn't see a German plane. There didn't even seem to be many of ours.
We began to say, it looks as if the German Air Force has been destroyed after all.
Surely they'd use it now, if they'd ever use it. Where were the fearful rocket devices they'd threatened us with? And the radio-controlled bombs and gliders? And the secret devices by which they could practically stop the whole invasion by pressing a button in Berlin? Was it all a myth? It looked like it. And some were even saying the West Wall itself was a myth. But if it was, believe me, it was democracy in arms that made it a myth. The wall was there, all right. Not as bad as we expected, but it was there. It was British and American skill and firepower. And above all, the heroism of the assault troops that scaled the wall. And as for the Nazis, they must have been put out of action by the bombers during these past few weeks, and by the commandos and paratroops. I've been through many battles, but I was never as excited as when my time came to go ashore. For this was France, and the beginning of the end. The rough, swirling tide carried our assault craft over the obstacles, and we jumped into more water than we expected. 6 feet of it. So I had to swim a yard or two with my pack and waterproof typewriter before I could wade to shore. Then the struggle across the soft sand. 5 minutes that will always be vivid in my mind. A few shells were falling on the beaches, a few mines still exploding. The whole beach covered with small craft. Men at work organizing the beaches already. Bulldozers widening the exits and laying the wire carpet. Ammunition and tanks and supplies and vehicles and guns coming ashore as far as the eye could see on that strange historic morning. In the sands, the dead who had made it possible. The first German prisoner sitting in slit trenches, some sullen, some smiling. The wounded Canadians. And everywhere the soldiers and vehicles rolling forward into battle and down the little lovely lanes of Normandy. And the first German aircraft diving in at last to drop a few bombs and open up on us with their cannon guns. At first glance, you'd have said, looking at that beach, what an unbelievable pandemonium. But there was no pandemonium. There was order and organization and skill as well as heroism. Everything planned to the most minute detail and working smoothly there on the beaches of France. And they had to work smoothly. This was only the beginning. The great battles were to come. I went over the beach and down a lane with Major Roy Oliver, a British officer whom I'd been with in Tobruk and at Alamein, and my friend Captain Placide Labelle. We spoke to the first civilian we saw. He was an Italian. Then I saw men, women, and children taking shelter behind a hedge. I went over to them. They embraced me, and I made an absurd little speech in French. We went on down the lane, and I saw a French woman putting roses on the face of a dead Canadian. I went into a house to start writing. A woman brought me eggs and strawberries and cream. In a half daze, I began to write. We had broken in. We were in France. This is Matthew Halton of the CBC, speaking from England.